All right, so I would like to talk about something a little bit different. Using diffuse gamma ray observations in the GV range to place possible constraints on the cosmic star formation history. Although this is still very much a feasibility study, because the satellite that is going to take the actual observations for us, GLAST, has not been launched yet. It is scheduled to be launched in April of 2008. Many people have already worked on many aspects of this feasibility study, and I list them here in order of increasing seniority. So let me start with an outline. So let me summarize what I will not be talking about. I will say nothing about ultra-high energy cosmic rays and observations from the Pierre Auger Observatory, multi-wavelength, multi-messenger studies of high-energy systems, anything about the high-energy properties of AGN or analytic models of cosmic structure formation and environmental effects on those. But all these subjects are very dear to my heart, so if they click with you, I will be here until the end of the week, and I would love to talk to you about any of these subjects, especially number one. Okay. So let me start with my one transparency summary of GEV gamma ray astronomy. So I say GEV, but I really mean energies between 100 MeV and 100 GEV. So these are gamma rays that the universe is transparent to, so we can see at cosmological distances, and they have to be measured from space. They do not penetrate the atmosphere. So during the 1990s, observations in this energy range were made by EGRET, the telescope aboard the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, and that mission ended in 2000, and now we're expecting GLAST to be launched in April of 2008, which will represent a really big improvement in sensitivity, angular resolution capabilities in general. So this is what the EGRET Olszky map looks like. This is a plot of every single GEV between 100 and MeV and 100 GEV gamma rays detected by EGRET. This is in galactic coordinates, so the galactic plane is here, galactic poles are there, galactic center. So what can we see on this map? We can see the diffuse emission from the Milky Way, and this is clearly the brightest thing on the sky. Also point sources. We had several classes of point sources that we understand, i.e. pulsars, active galactic nuclei, and normal galaxies, which other than the Milky Way detected one more normal galaxy, the LMC. And many, many other point sources, actually most of the point sources that EGRET detected, that to this day we do not know what they are. They are the unidentified gamma ray sources. And other than that, other than the point sources and the diffuse emission from the Milky Way, we also detect diffuse emission, looked isotropic, so presumably it's extragalactic, which is called the extragalactic gamma ray background. So as you go to high latitudes and you subtract all point sources and all emission from the Milky Way, you model this out, you're still left with some isotropic component that probably is the emission of all unresolved below EGRET sensitivity extragalactic objects that emit gamma rays. So this is gamma ray astronomy. And now, one of the questions that still remain unresolved to this day is what makes up the extragalactic gamma ray background. The easy answer is we don't know, but there are some things we do know about it. There are some contributions that are guaranteed. So there are some classes of sources that you detect individual members of, the bright end of the luminosity function, active galactic nuclei, and normal galaxies, and also whatever part of these unidentified sources that are extragalactic. So you see the brightest members are bright enough to be resolved by EGRET, but you also know that there have to be more active galaxies, normal galaxies, and whatever these objects are that are further away, that are fainter. So they're not individually resolved, but this doesn't stop them from emitting, so they contribute collectively to the extragalactic background. And you also may have truly diffuse emission contributing to the background. And when I say truly diffuse, I mean that there may be things that are too large in scale and too low in surface brightness for us to ever be hopeful to detect them individually as point sources. One example is structure formation shocks. These are very, very large scale on the sky, so probably they will not be, if they are accelerating particles and they are emitting gamma rays, they will not be detected as individual sources. And also you may have exotic physics, dark matter annihilation.
Can I ask, when you say normal galaxies, you mean events within those normal galaxies. It's not somehow a property of the galaxy as a whole, right? Presumably the active galaxy is the AGN that you're referring to. Mm-hmm. So what is the property that you're thinking inside these normal galaxies?
Thank you. Exactly. Okay. So I will say something very brief, and that's my next transparency. Interactions between cosmic rays and the interstellar medium. But I will come back to that. So let me show you, for the classes of objects that we think we know what they are, what their contribution to the extragalactic background looks like. So what I'm showing here is the spectrum of the extragalactic gamma ray background as a function of energy, and what I'm plotting in the y-axis is energy squared times its number intensity, so basically this is energy flux. The data points are the measurements of egret, and the little dots, it's kind of humbling, but these are the systematic uncertainties in determining the extragalactic background from egret measurements, and the main source of these systematic uncertainties is that you have to model out and subtract the emission from the Milky Way, and it's not immediately obvious that we can do this very well, but that's subject for a different discussion. And then with the colored lines, I'm plotting our best guess spectra of what we think different guaranteed contributions should look like. Now, in blue, you have the unidentified sources. So this is actually the most numerous classes of gamma ray sources, so presumably they will have a sizable contribution to the extragalactic background as well. And with the red line, you have blazars, active galactic nuclei. And so what I would like you to take from here is the shape of these curves, not necessarily the height, because for these classes of objects, we have kind of normalized the spectrum to its maximal possible contribution without overproducing the EGRB. But it is likely that if you have discrete point sources making up most of the extragalactic gamma ray background, this is where they will be more or less. Now, with a purple line, this is...
Before you go to the purple line, could you comment on that feature at several GeV?
Yes, this
feature.
Oh, this, okay, all right. So this is very interesting. The first thing I want to say as a disclaimer is that you see the systematic uncertainties, it might not be there. Now, this having been said, there have been exciting possible interpretations of this feature, one of them being that that could be the dark matter. So if you have a dark matter particle annihilating it around these energies, it could make such a feature. Now, the unfortunate thing about these interpretations is that you actually have enough data to invert the problem and calculate a dark matter profile, what you would expect to, because other than the spectrum, you also have a spatial distribution of these gamma rays. And if you look at the dark matter profile, it doesn't look anything like we expect from cosmological simulations. It looks more like what you would expect baryonic matter to do. So it has a disk, it has a big ring, so it's kind of unclear how dark matter could be doing this. So the excitement has subsided a little bit.
But the people who worry about the systematics, could the systematics be a strong function of energy?
Oh, the systematics could be a strong function of energy, and in fact they are. The reason is that... And again, it has to do with how well we can model the emission from the galaxy. So the primary emission, I will come to that again, the primary type of emission that you expect at energies above 1 GeV is proton-proton interactions between cosmic rays and the ISM. But this is kind of a well-understood problem because you can measure the cosmic ray spectrum, you can measure the distribution of gas in the galaxy, you know the interaction of the cross-section of the proton-proton interaction. There are not as many free parameters in this problem. And when you crank it all up, it turns out that this does not agree with observations. So this is a big debate in gamma ray astronomy. Why can't we understand this very well? And the problem is energy dependent. So above 1 GeV, it turns out that the problem is more pronounced. Around 1 GeV, you kind of understand what happens, and this is why you have this bump here. This is the spectrum of what the typical spectrum of a normal galaxy would look like. It comes from the pion mass multiplied by E squared. But above 1 GeV, things don't happen exactly how you would like them to. In fact, you appear to have more gamma ray emission than you would expect. And there are different camps on how to explain this discrepancy. One is it may have something to do with the instrument. So it may be with the instrument, with EGRET. So it might be something in EGRET energy calibration that we don't understand very well. Another very popular interpretation by Andy Strong, collaborators in Germany, is that we might not understand very well the spectrum of cosmic rays as a function of location in the galaxy. So what you measure locally in balloons, these energies, is not necessarily what happens at the acceleration sources. So after you propagate them, you might change the spectrum by a lot, but you may have most of the emission, in fact, close to the acceleration sites as inverse Compton from, say, electrons that are accelerated closer. So that also may produce an energy-dependent discrepancy in what we expect for the emission from the Milky Way, and then this translates in uncertainties in the extragalactic background because you have to subtract the Milky Way. But the most exciting prospect would be if this were the dark matter, but glass will tell. This is the safest answer. So the purple line here is what the cumulative spectrum from all the normal galaxies we think looks like. And the thing to note here is that this is very different than what the other classes of point sources look like, just because you have this around a GeV, this peak, that is a result of the pion decay gamma rays, pions being produced in the proton-proton interactions, not going below a certain energy threshold. So this is what creates this cutoff here. Now, why is this very interesting? Okay, so let's see. How did we get the purple curve, and why do we think we can use it to do cosmology? So for a single galaxy, as I very briefly mentioned, you have this interaction going. So you have cosmic ray protons, high energy, interacting with interstellar medium protons, producing neutral pions and gamma rays. And from this already, you can see what type of input you need to calculate the gamma ray flux from a single galaxy. So you need to know something about the cosmic ray flux of these objects. And under the assumption that most of the cosmic ray acceleration takes place in supernova remnants, you could say something about the cosmic ray flux of these objects if you know something about the supernova rate, which then relates to the star formation of these galaxies. And the second thing you need to know is their gas content, how many targets you have for these cosmic rays to interact with. So that's for one galaxy. Now let me translate this to the population of normal galaxies in the universe. You would need the number of galaxies per unit cosmic volume, and you would need the cosmic ray flux in these galaxies. So,
can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. I'm puzzled by the gas content.
Yes.
If I'm in a steady state, if I have 10 times more gas, that just means each cosmic ray will last a tenth as much time, so I still get the same number of gamma rays, wouldn't I?
Say again. I'm not sure I understand your question. If I have a certain cosmic ray.
I have a rate at which I'm producing the cosmic rays.
Right.
And at least for the cosmic rays, if most of the cosmic rays escape from the galaxy, then my comment is invalid. But if the energies you're talking about, a lot of the cosmic rays actually live out their whole lives in
right.
the galaxy.
Right, absolutely.
Then it doesn't matter how much gas there is, because that the rate of cosmic ray production is equal to the rate of, it gives you the rate of gamma ray production. And it doesn't matter whether each cosmic ray takes 100 million years to give it up or 10 million years to give it up.
Okay, so this assumes that basically what determines your cosmic ray flux is losses through this mechanism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, we believe that this is not the case. The escape rate is what determines the cosmic ray flux, and that's not... This mechanism goes pretty slowly, actually. So it's not what determines the steady state cosmic ray flux. All right, so...
So they're lost to the galaxy?
Yes.
Most of the cosmic rays are lost to the intergalactic medium.
This is what determines the cosmic ray flux. This is how you lose them. You lose them faster than you lose them through this interaction.
Okay.
leaky box?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then they find another galaxy.
Well, it's too low density.
Okay? All right. So, again, for the population of unresolved galaxies, you would need to know how many galaxies you have per unit cosmic volume, what kind of supernova rate you have in those, so what the supernova rate looks like as a function of redshift, and also what the gas fraction in these objects looks as a function of redshift. The interesting part comes next. How you combine these three inputs that are necessary to calculate how much emission you expect from normal galaxies, and the way you calculate them, you can combine them in such a way that you can express them, or you can express the appropriate combination of those, as a function of only the cosmic star formation rate, how much gas goes into stars per unit time, per unit cosmic volume, as a function of redshift. And this is what makes this interesting. So, if this is the main...
Is that just an algebraic...
Yes.
Well, it
is an algebraic miracle. Unfortunately, it requires a few assumptions. So, for example, one assumption that it requires is that every cosmic ray sees the same column density of gas before it interacts as it does in the Milky Way, for example. And that is not necessarily obvious, especially since confinement is important. So one of the important follow-ups then after you do the calculation I'm talking about is to see how much uncertainty you introduce by doing these assumptions. A second assumption, which in principle also looks bad and it makes cosmologists very upset, but it turns out that if you work out its details, it's not that important, is you assume closed-box galaxies to make this miracle happen. And we all know that galaxies are not closed boxes. They accrete gas, and they may even lose gas. But in fact, the correction is very small, and it's calculable. So. All right. So if this is your only input, then you can invert the problem and use detections of this effect to constrain your cosmic star formation history. So let me show you some very preliminary results of how the cosmic star formation history would translate in what you expect for the contribution of normal galaxies to the extragalactic gamma ray background. Okay, so this is again is expected energy flux for the background, so expect the cumulative flux for all normal galaxies as a function of energy. And I have made this calculation with four different cosmic star formation history curves. Now, these are completely made-up curves. They are so normalized that they all give at the end the same amount of star formation, but they just peak at different redshifts. Okay, so you can see that there are two things that may happen. One is that the peak can move in energy, and this is easily understood. You just have this pion-bump peak that is basically redshifted, and depending on how far back your star formation peaks, your star formation history peaks, then most of the gamma rays that are produced are redshifted at different energies. And the second thing that happens is that this peak moves up and down, and this has a little bit to do with how your gas fraction evolves. So if you tune it so that you have most of your targets at the same epoch that you have most of your star formation going, then you would get the biggest peak.
But I thought in a closed box model, you can't change that, can you?
You can change what?
I thought that you have all the gas to begin with. That was
right.
My interpretation.
Right.
So when if I made half my stars, I've used up half the gas.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I
exactly.
Think that you can't. So there's no free parameter with the gas.
Well, there is a free parameter on when this happens.
But that's
Just
that Zmax.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Yes. All right.
Okay, now I'm still confused.
Yes.
So
now you're still confused.
Yeah.
That's a very good expression.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So in about your response to Chris's question, so if you assume the galaxies have all the gas they're gonna have at the start.
Yes.
Then so is the idea that you can then you'll keep the gas but you'll vary the star formation rate. You have the gas at the start but you delay the star formation, and so you can arrange it so that the star formation. Yeah, well, okay, yeah, I guess I'm still confused about the answer to your question, that why is there any freedom in assigning how much gas you have when the star formation rate is, or when you have a certain amount of stars, or when the star formation rate is whatever?
Right, so you start with 100% gas.
Yeah.
Right, and then you start converting this into stars.
Right.
Right. If you convert it into stars only in one burst.
Okay.
Right. Then you just trickle star formation. Mm-hmm. You may still have any cosmic rays that you form from this point on will not make any gamma rays because they don't have any targets to interact with. That's the principle of the thing.
I see. Okay, so it's a question about the shape of the star formation.
Yes, because this is the only thing that's changing here, the shape of the star formation
okay.
curve.
But that presumably is fixed by the physics of star formation. I mean, really,
right.
There should be, you know, if you've got a certain amount of gas in the galaxy, it really ought to make stars at a certain rate, period.
Yes, well, and I want to measure this.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
All right?
If you fix per galaxy the amount of gas, the height of this thing is telling me basically how many galaxies are out there doing star formation. It's telling me about the cosmic total amount of star formation that's going on, but that's a number we think we know from looking at things like sub-millimeter
yes.
galaxies.
No. Yes. Oh. That is not. Yes, this is a good question. No, it is not telling us that.
Oh.
So the height of this, if you were allowed to change the height of the star formation curve arbitrarily, so change the total amount of star formation that has happened in the galaxy, yes, this curve would go up and down. No, this is not what happens here. There is an additional way in which you can change the height of this curve, and this is by saying what kind of gas fraction you had, even if the total amount of star formation that you do is the same.
How much gas you're left over within the
exactly.
Area. Okay, fair enough. That's also measurable.
Right. Why isn't the black curve above and to the right of the red curve? Why is it not monotonic?
Yes? What? The
well,
black curve?
Why is it not monotonic with redshift, the evolution of the
space? Yes, it's not monotonic with time exactly for this reason. Because the highest this curve can go is when it so arranges itself that you have the best combination of gas fraction and and star formation rate happening at the same time. And this is not monotonic. You can have all your star formation rate in the beginning and all your star formation rate at the end, right, as two extreme cases, and this will kind of give you...
If you have all your star formation rate at the end, that means I kept my gas till the end, too. So I still
right.
have, like I was saying, when I turned half the gas into stars, it doesn't really matter when I did it, I would then be... interacting. So I agree with that. I didn't understand how you're going to go up and down.
Okay.
I thought the other one was right. monotonic because...
So now remember that the normalization is also fixed, which means that the total area under the curve is also fixed. Between redshift 0.01 and today, you just don't have enough time left to generate all the stars necessary. So even if the star formation peaks... So what I'm not showing you here...
Oh, you didn't make. You're saying in that case you did not make the number of stars we see.
No, I did make the number of stars I see, but I have to have been making some already. So this case is not all the star formation rate happens today.
Okay.
It's just the peak is fixed that is very close to today. But that is not the same as all of the star formation happening today and nothing before, because then I would not have enough time between this time and today to make all the stars that I need to make.
So
what I'm not showing you here, and I should be showing you, is these curves. In fact, that would help a lot.
Right, okay. So the shape of the SFR versus Z curve isn't the same for all those different Z maxes?
No.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Curve shape there.
Now I'm imagining you just take four Madal plots and shift the...
No. Yes, that is not what I've done. This is not a realistic star formation curve. Okay? This is just a curve that would be manipulated enough so that I can make this point.
Okay.
All right? This is not what it should look like in reality.
Is there an equation we can look at?
I will show you an equation you can look at. So first of all, let me show you this plot. So this is what it should look like with a Madal plot curve that we get from low-energy observations from optical infrared, that's in fact calculated as it should be. Now let me show you an equation you can look at. This is your equation. When you're done looking at it. So this is the intensity in gamma rays, number intensity. All right, so these are all normalization constants, and you shouldn't worry too much about them. This is the Milky Way spectrum in gamma rays, appropriately redshifted to the redshift for your producing the gamma rays. So this is the cosmic star formation history, amount of gas going into stars per unit, cosmic volume per unit time, right? And this is the way the cosmic star formation rate enters to make the cosmic rays, right? So this is where we assume that the cosmic ray flux is proportional to the star formation rate. And then this factor here is correcting for the gas content. So you start from a galaxy that looks like the Milky Way today. It has a 1 to 10 ratio of gas to stars. And then you're trying to say, okay, so if every galaxy evolved backwards in time, starting from Milky Way, but following the cosmic star formation rate history, what would be its gas content at redshift z?
So what is rho dot of z? I mean, what's the functional form of rho dot z?
That was called 2001. They had the feed to infrared data, I believe. So that's what we used.
But when you vary z max,
yes,
how do you accomplish that?
Right. So you just, let's see, what functional form did we pick? So that was a distribution, basically some distribution with single parametric family of distributions with a normalization. And that's how you accomplish that.
Okay, but it's one where the shape depends on Cmax.
Pretty much. Yes, okay. It does.
But you're not trying to pretend that this is right. You're just trying to show that you
yes.
have the ability
that there is an effect.
To see different
yes.
types of
mm-hmm.
flows. Okay. So we shouldn't get too hung up on whether you did
no.
that correctly or not.
Well, you shouldn't believe any of these curves. The only point that I want to make here is if by some miracle, not by true star formation physics, the cosmic star formation rate looked very different than it does look in reality, then you would have a very different shape and very different normalization for this spectral feature. Believable?
Yeah.
Go. All right. Can I take the equation off? Everybody done looking at it? All right. Now let's see. Okay. That's not what I want. That's what I want. I believe we were... Okay, wonderful. Now, although we went over most of this, let me just say to summarize. So the way we did it until now, in 2002, in the purple curve that I showed you, that I told you should believe, because that comes from a real Madaw plot, we have used our knowledge of the cosmic star formation rate history as is given to us by low-energy observations, low-energy photons, H-alpha, UV, infrared, to predict what the normal galaxy signal would look like for gamma-ray telescopes. And the prediction is it should have a peak at energies around 1 GeV, and it is probably something like a third of the way below what the flux at 1 GeV is as EGOT measured it. So if gas goes up, and it does observe this, remember you heard it here first. Now, what we can do in the future after GLAST goes up? We have good reason to believe that GLAST will observe the spectral peak, and it will allow us to invert the problem. So, yes?
How many parameters does your model have?
Good question. So, it basically has one. but it's a curve. It's a function of redshift.
It's got a free curve.
Yes, it has a free curve.
I'm wondering if you will have enough data to do this in a non-parametric fashion by just binning the cosmic star formation history in redshift bins and saying, having the volumetric rate in each bin be a free parameter of the model, and then trying to back it out that way.
I think, so I will come back to that. So from the technical point of view, basically this is exactly what we would like to do ultimately. You cannot, I'm not saying that you can reproduce the whole star formation rate history from gamma observations. Let's make this disclaimer. I'm just saying that the parameter space we are left with low energy observations is large enough that we can take chunks out of it with gamma observations, and I will come to that. All right. So two reasons why I believe this is doable. The first is why I think GLAST will see this feature, and the second thing is how well I think GLAST needs to do before we start having interesting results. So let me go back to this plot. Okay. So the EGRET results for the background are here, and what we expect for this feature is this. So right now, this is not happening at all, not even a little bit. It's just not there. Why do I think it will be different with GLAST? Okay, now, bear with me for just a second. Active galactic nuclei and point sources in gamma rays, like unidentified sources, are bright, bright things. Individually very bright in gamma rays. GLAST goes up, GLAST has a better sensitivity by a factor of 40. It will resolve, let's see, anywhere between 1,000 and 10,000 of these objects, depending on whose luminosity function you believe, all the way down to confusion limit. That's what we expect GLAST to do. This means that if indeed...
So how many did EGRET resolve?
60.
But I thought they were mainly unidentified. So
yes.
It's resolved, presumably with better angular resolution, right. A lot of the unidentified sources would become...
Correct.
So what are the total number of point sources that EGRET saw compared to the number of this?
So EGRET saw a total number of about 250, 260 point sources.
Oh, okay. So it's about 10 times more.
It's about 10 times more. At least 10 times more. So
what is the resolution? What is the spatial resolution?
That is a very much energy dependent and spectrum dependent and flux dependent answer. So the single photon resolution is of the order of a degree. So you can see where the problem is. It's not that you don't have many things below behind that could be making the gamma rays. It's just that you don't know which one. Now, GLAST, for the sources that EGRET saw, for these 200, 300 sources, will do much, much better. So probably we'll have good identification for the EGRET unidentified sources. We'll understand what those are. But it will, for the other thousands that it will detect, they will still be right at the flux resolution limit, which means you'll only have a handful of photons detected from them. We're talking about 5 and 10 photons above background. That's how you do gamma rays. It's amazing that you can do it at all. At the instrument resolution limit. So again, you will have very, very poor angular resolution, and you will have
create with X-ray observation or something like that.
And in that way, you would probably identify populations of sources, but it's not the same as saying this source has this lower energy counterparts. Yes. All right. We're almost there. Okay. So the resolving these tens of thousands. These thousands up to 10,000 new objects will bring the diffuse background down. Now, the question is, how many of the normal galaxies do you resolve out, and how much this curve gets reduced? So GLAST will detect 4 normal galaxies, the Milky Way, the LMC, the SMC, M31, and it's done. So although you have many, many normal galaxies, and each of those does its little thing with its cosmic rays and the interactions with interstellar gas, and all of them emit some gamma rays. Individually, they're just very faint.
But they are the diffuse background, aren't they? Isn't that what you were using? The normal galaxies were, in essence...
No. They have a guaranteed contribution to the diffuse background. They do make a certain chunk, this much, of the diffuse background. They cannot make all of it. That I promise you.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
All right?
Yep.
Okay, so what happens is the data go down by a factor of 3. And as you drain the swamp, you start seeing the alligators. And basically, you see this feature, and you can measure it. Now, the second question is, how much of this feature do you need to measure? How good a job do you need to do? Now, remember that there are two things that happen as I change my star formation history. This peak goes up and down, and it goes right and left. So the only thing that I need from GLASS data in order to make some constraint is for them to tell me how high this peak is and where it lies in energy. And that's not a hard calculation. I believe this GLASS will be able to do. Okay, so my conclusions. So I believe we have extensively discussed how the cosmic star formation history is imprinted on the extragalactic gamma ray background. I have only talked about the first way that this happens with the normal galaxy spectral feature at 1 GeV. If you want more entertainment, ask me later about the extragalactic background light absorption feature at 20 GeV. And GLASS will resolve thousands of bright point sources, so the normal galaxy feature at 1 GeV expects to become visible. So instead of using the cosmic star formation history to predict what this feature looks like, once you detect the feature, you can use it to try and constrain the parameter space allowable to us from low energy observations for the cosmic star formation history. Thank you. Now, I'm waiting for the uncertainty question.
let's pick one. So if you go to a high redshift,
yes,
and you take a galaxy of the same mass,
yes,
the Milky Way, it's more compact, say, a redshift 3.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It will increase your flux, doesn't it? I mean, there's a common density that enters before it escapes. And so and you've done many of these sort of projective-type modeling. So what do you expect? The type of uncertainty you have just from that, or how much can you vary the signal?
That's very easy, though, to model in. That's no problem at all. It's a well-understood...
Within the assumption that most of the gas were distributed as an average within the halo, which obviously is...
On the other hand, if you make the opposite distribution, the opposite assumption, say, that, well, all of the gas is collapses to rotationally supported disks and so forth and so forth, but still, this is a calculable feature as a function of redshift.
What I'm wondering is, between those two extremes, do I get a factor of 10 or 100 difference in my flux?
So it's not as bad as you may think. So what it would do is it would not necessarily change your overall result, but it would smear out how well you do in time. So let's for a moment think about a halo, right? So in the halo, you have all these gas distributed, and then in the middle you have a disk which produces the cosmic rays, which then escape and go and interact with the halo gas, right? So what happens is if you just assume that they interact with the gas that has halo density, what you're really saying is they're interacting post-escape. And this on occasion happens as well. And so, however, the time that they interact with after they're produced is a little bit different because it does not respond to the star formation rate at the same redshift. So that would be how you would introduce most of your uncertainty.
The light crossing time is very short, though.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the light crossing time that enters this. It's the confinement, the escape timescape from the galaxy. So even between the two extremes, the factor by which, there were two parts in your question. The first was what happens if you go backwards in redshift and you're more compressed, right? And that is calculable. It's a very straightforward function of redshift, and you can include it in the model. Now the second part is that, even so, though, you have two different cases. One is you're in the galaxy, and one you're in the halo. And in this case, things are not as straightforward, but still we have started calculating this effect, and it looks like it's not going to be so big of a disaster. It just changes a little bit where you how you respond as a function of redshift to the peak of the star formation history.
So do you care at all about magnetic fields? And so one of the reasons I ask is there's this recent work by Todd Thompson et al. If a significant fraction of the star formation is in submillimeter galaxy type things, and the magnetic fields in those galaxies are at sort of an equipartition level, the dominant cosmic ray loss mechanism may be synchrotron cooling. And that would presumably mean you'd have a lot fewer cosmic rays available per unit star formation to make GeV gamma rays. So have you looked at that effect?
So that, of course, depends very much on the type of galaxy in which most of your star formation rate happens.
Yes.
And so in the extreme case, this effect would limit, could be taken to limit the amount or constrain the amount of star formation happening in this type of galaxies. So when I say normal galaxy, meaning normal as in not active, not starburst, not ultraluminous in infrared. So this would be the extreme case where you don't want to include this effect at all.
Okay, right? But I mean, I don't know, do we have a good sense what fraction of the total star formation is in things that look like Eulers? I mean, I've heard varying estimates.
Exactly.
Ten to the third solar masses per year.
Right, but I mean, when you multiply by the fact that those are rare, you know, what fraction of total stars formed in the universe are formed in Eulers?
And I think the answer is we don't know.
Okay.
And that would be one way to constrain this.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, if I could pursue that, we had a couple of talks earlier in the workshop by observers who were looking at galaxies in high redshift. And one of the points they made was that typically the starbursts are not very important. And then what a lot of times you call starbursts aren't starbursts, it's all galaxies are doing that. But the average star formation rate as you go back in redshift, you're looking at redshift of a few, the typical star formation rate is 100 solar masses a year. And then sort of the question is in your, and that those are normal galaxies in some sense. So they're not like the Milky Way is today, but that was a normal galaxy in redshift of a few. So maybe this is also partly related, I think, to Tom's question. So if you, if you consider that normal galaxies were behaving very differently than Milky Way is today, how much does that affect your conclusions?
It does. Mm-hmm. It does. So there are a couple of ways to address this. The first way would be to actually try and integrate all of the knowledge of what other galaxies do as a function of redshift and how this would affect us. So this is something we're pursuing, and it looks like it may be at the order of a few tens of percent effect. So depending, there are different ways to make your assumptions about different ways that galaxies look different as a function of redshift. On the other hand, as I said, in the extreme, the answer I gave to Mark, in the extreme case, and depending on whether you can confidently say in which way you would expect the effect to go. So if, for example, you said, well, I don't really expect so many GeV gamma rays from galaxies that look radically different than our own, then in this case, I would go back to the question that I gave to Mark, that this type of feature would constrain then the amount of star formation that has taken place in conditions similar to the galaxies that we are now. However, if this definitely needs to be studied independently, because there is the other extreme as well. In starbursts, you do have much more star formation. And in principle, all other effects taken away, that would mean that you would have a much higher gamma ray flux. Now, fortunately, GLASS will be very good in this sense, because it will give us an independent check on how different the behavior of starbursts is than the behavior of galaxies like the Milky Way. Because the number I said four about the normal galaxies that are going to be detected by GLASS, this only refers to Milky Way type galaxies. Starbursts, we have something like 10 or even more that are good candidates for being detected by GLASS. So what you do in this case, you do study individual cases of how gamma rays and star formation are related in these systems, and then you correct for that in flight.
Can I ask a really, really simple question? And that is, what is the distance that, what is the column density path through which my typical cosmic ray goes before it does interact? We've said all along that I could, most of these cosmic rays get out, right? You said they aren't stuck inside the galaxy. Most of them are getting out. So what is the typical, I just want to know what the number is.
Yeah.
It's got to be more than 10 to the 20.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, they'd all get stuck. No,
it's like, I think, almost 100 grams per square centimeter.
They got to get this, so, okay.
In order to...
To stop a cosmic.
Let me ask if there are any more questions. I'm looking for it, and I will answer.
A very simple question. Yes. So maybe this goes back again to what people have been asking about. But what is the physics behind Zmax? And I mean, what does that tell us in terms of some big picture? I mean, what is the underlying physics that determines Zmax? It sounds like there's a lot of different things that go into this one parameter, or am I mistaken?
Absolutely. Disclaimer, I'm not trying to understand the physics of Zmax. I'm just trying to measure Zmax through gamma rays. So there are much more qualified people than me to answer about that, what the physics of Zmax is. Of course, the zeroth order answer is that Zmax is at 1, everything happens at redshift 1. It's just the right combination of how close things are to one another and how much structure formation has proceeded that lots of things happen in the universe at redshift 1. But other than that, if there is more excitement, I will let other people answer that.
I think this question has the same answer as a lot of the other ones, actually, but I'll ask it all the same. So the cosmic ray confinement that you assume, you just assume that the cosmic rays are confined like in the Milky Way. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So we assume no evolution in the structure of the magnetic field in galaxies.
Yes. So what about that? Part of it goes back to the answer I gave Tom. So what happens if the confinement is very different? Will these things not interact? And this goes back to what Professor McKee was saying earlier, where of course they will interact eventually. If in the extreme case where you just let them go, they just go and they keep going. You don't have losses other than this mechanism. This is the primary mechanism for losses, proton-proton interaction. So they just go until they interact with something in the intergalactic medium. So you're not losing.
They have to go an awful long way.
Yes, they do. They do. Yes, but right. But in the end, they will interact. So you don't.
Not between now and then, right?
Yeah, well, they interact at Hubble time, even in the intergalactic medium.
Well, you have stuff in the intergalactic medium.
Well,
that
goes to the question.
Could it be filling up the intergalactic medium with cosmic rays?
I'm getting to that.
Yeah, how much of a column do you have to go through?
So it's many grams per square centimeter for nuclear interactions.
Right, so it's many grams per square centimeter. I don't think from here to the last scattering surface is many grams per square centimeter.
Yeah, but you don't have to take this to be the mean density of the intergalactic medium in a cosmic volume, right? So they escape from the galaxy, and then where do they go? They go in the galaxy's halo, which is already a factor of a few hundred above the mean, and then they escape this world. Maybe the galaxy's in a cluster, so they're in the intracluster medium. It's not the same thing as expecting them to interact in the mean cosmic volume density.
Actually, no, but if you get it high enough, then you're not, which is, you know, it's just a few centimeters.
The line across as a plastic distribution, you know, doesn't have much structure. So it actually, it would be very close to the mean color density, even if it's, you know.
Even if you start out at a peak.
Only if you, could create lots and lots of tiny, extraordinarily high density peaks, could you get that line integral to be very different from a smooth.
Right. Which means we're basically, if they're getting out of the galaxy, we're basically just filling up the universe with cosmic rays.
Well, but then you also, I would worry, I mean, what the magnetic field, the intergalactic magnetic field is, because you do have another loss channel, which is synchrotron. And
not for photons.
It's very slow, but I mean, we have a Hubble time. Mm-hmm.
It might be 10 to the minus 10 gas. It's 10 to the minus 9 gas. It's not
okay. Okay.
So you said when you were referring to Todd Thompson's paper, was that you were talking proton synchrotron, or was that just electrons?
That was electrons. Okay.
So you don't call the protons.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, it is kind of unclear of how you distribute the energy in these cases between proton acceleration and electron acceleration.
That's true.
This, for example, is one very big part in this issue of the GeV excess. So one way you could make the discrepancy between the observed Milky Way spectrum and the expected Milky Way spectrum would be, instead of putting all of your acceleration in and your cosmic ray energy into protons, putting much more of it into electrons and having locally inverse quantum at the sources. So that would make the problem go away to a certain extent. So we may have this going even in the Milky Way to some extent, not only starburst galaxies. But this, in fact, GLASS will be very good to tell us the answer to that, because it will have the angular resolution of the power to resolve individual supernova elements and acceleration sources and tell us what's happening more or less.
Just another question. There was a prodigy way back when where you showed that you had the systematic errors. The systematic errors seem to get really big, just a few things right over from the peak is.
Yes.
So it would seem, I mean, is it somehow GLASS is going to not have these same sort of systematic
problems? That is exactly it. That is one of the wonderful things about GLASS. So this systematic uncertainty?
Yeah, exactly. Because if you notice, just
this the peak here
is just a little bit over. So it would seem that if you shift that, in terms of resolving the Milky Way, you would have the exact same sort of problem.
Right. So this is exactly the GeV excess business. This is exactly the fact that we cannot model out very well the Milky Way. GLAST will do much better than this in many different ways. So this is the maximum discrepancy. So the way you model out the Milky Way and then you subtract it to get the extragalactic background is worst here. So this is basically, you just don't know what to do. Should you go with what your model tells you and pretend that the rest of it is not there? Should you try to fit your observations and then subtract even away close to the poles? It's kind of unclear what the best way to go about here is, and this is what causes the open up in the systematic uncertainties. Now, what GLASS will do different is it will do a much better job in looking at different sites in the Milky Way individually. So as you can see, if indeed there is a spectrum variation that would be expected if you had, if what's causing this is cosmic ray spectrum variation locally at the source or from source to source. And the second thing it will do, it will see other galaxies. So you can immediately see if this is a local Milky Way problem or if it persists in all normal galaxies or it is an instrumental problem. By looking at multiple sites and multiple galaxies, you can gain a much better understanding of what the normal your single individual Milky Way does, and then this translates into reduction of uncertainties in your background. This is a known problem; it will go away, hopefully.
Okay, I think we should thank Basil.